the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Shagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagelani-Albov. We're so excited to have you here with us this month. We are going to be talking about a topic that has infused into some of our other conversations, but we haven't really approached it head on. Also, we're going to be moving to a new geographical context tonight. We're going to be talking to somebody who is doing their work in the Philippines, which is an area that we haven't yet talked about in our podcast conversation. So there's lots of new and exciting things that are going to be happening today.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. I mean, especially I feel like these issues of labor and the environment coming together are something that are so central and important. But you know, we just haven't had anybody on yet that has that both technical and theoretical expertise.
Yes, very much. There's a lot of on-the-ground experience that we're going to be getting an insider view on. So without further ado, I would like to introduce Joshua Mehta.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Chris. Hello, Sophia. And hello to your listeners.
Thank you so much for joining us here tonight. So would you like to tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Well, thank you for inviting me. So my name is Joshua Mehta. I am the Secretary General of CENTRO, which is one of the national labor centers in the Philippines. And being a secretary general, it actually just simply means that I'm the secretary to too many generals in my organization. So don't put too much in the title. So that's what I do. I've been in the labor movement for the past three decades. And I've actually, you know, in the past three decades, I never really felt that I ever worked in an, you know, even a single day, because it's, for me, this is not work. This is my life. This is my vocation, if you like.
Absolutely. So how did you get into labor movements?
Well, that's a long story, but let me try to shorten it. So I was still studying in the University of the Philippines, which is even during my at that time, even today, you know, is considered like the bastion of radicals. And because I was studying in that university while I was working, so I was a working student, many of my fellow workers thought that I knew everything about trade unionism, which was not necessarily true, but I never knew anything about trade unions. But when they invited me to a union meeting, I felt that it was something that I really, really wanted to do. So it was a really drastic turning point for me, because after that moment, I decided that that's what I wanted to do in my life. And so I dropped school. You know, I consider myself as part of that last batch of activists in the Philippines who really seriously believe that the real education comes from combat, comes from the struggle with the people. The real education is out there in the streets, not in the university. So, you know, I believe that, and, you know, I never looked back. And that's how I started in the labor movement. I actually started as an education officer of the hotel unions, which is a one of the smallest unions, if you like, in the Philippines. It's one of the smallest because it's the only union that has decided, one of the few unions, I should say, that actually decided to focus just on one particular industry. Because here, unionism is like generally called a general kind of a union, right? So you organize in all, most unions would organize in all sorts of industries. But my own organization, which is NURAIN, which is an affiliate of the International Union of Food and Allied Workers, way back in the 70s has decided it would focus solely on hotel and restaurant workers. And being so, it has always been small relative to other unions in the country. But that has had its advantages because it made them feel the need always, it always makes them feel that there is a need for them to work together with other unions. And that's the reason why they asked me to help build an alliance of unions, of allies with, you know, fellow travelers in the labor movement. And that's how we started building Alliance of Progressive Labor in 1996, which ended up to be essentially CENTRO about 13 years later. So CENTRO is the culmination of a life's work of trying to build bridges among unions in the public sector and the private sector, in the formal sector and informal sector, including the migrant workers. We fashioned ourselves. We're very proud of the idea that we made it popular in the country to start talking about social movement unionism all over again. So we believe that the trade unions must reform itself in the light of globalization in the 1980s. And one clear response to that was social movement unionism.
So what kind of effects has globalization had on the labor situation in the Philippines? You mentioned that things had shifted in the 1980s. Could you tell us a little bit more about that trajectory?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question, because the globalization has had a massive impact on the working class in the Philippines. For one thing, there was this introduction of labor flexibility in the country, which we call contractualization. I don't know what you call it. You call it temps, I think, no?
In the U.S. context, that would be a temporary worker. Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
In but the Finnish here, context, I'm not sure what word they use for it.
I don't know what the word you use for it. But here it was so massive to the point that it upended, you know, the whole labor market. I remember when I was still studying in the university and I started working for a fast food company. I remember that at that time, after 6 months of work, you are automatically considered as a regular employee. You would actually use your last salary to splurge around, you know, and party with your friends because you are a regular employee. You know? And at that time, out of, like, for example, if you have 100 workers, then easily about only 10% or less than 10% would be non-regular. But that was in the 80s. Now, when the country started opening up to globalization in a massive way in the middle 80s, by the middle 90s, things have started turning around. Today, we have the reverse of 100 workers. You'd be happy if you have if you've had 20 regular workers, and 80 or more would probably be non-regular. So it has reversed the situation. And with that reverse situation comes, of course, the weakening of the labor movement. Because in the Philippines, in the labor code, while the labor code says that every worker in the country who has had one day of work is allowed to join or even form a union, the fact of the matter is, if you are not a regular employee, you wouldn't even dare talk to a union official, because you'll be so afraid to be sacked by your employer when they find out that you are active in the union, or just thinking of being active in the union, because you are still under a contract. What the employers would simply do is just tell you the next day that I'm afraid we cannot renew your contract, and that's it. That's the end of it, no, for you. But this problem of contractualization has become so massive, so pervasive that people started coming up with a word for it. We call it endo. It's actually a shortcut. It's a colloquial word that describes end of contract. So, you know, when the youngsters would come together, you know, when they meet, you know, say, hey, how are you? Oh, right now I'm in endo. That means they were in end of contract, because now what's happening is that people are only provided jobs for 3 months or 5 months, and then their contract gets renewed even after more than 5 years or even 10 years. You could just keep on renewing. And because you are in a series of contractual work, you never get to be a regular worker. And that, by the simple magic of contractualization, employers in the country were able to prevent a huge section of the working class from actually accessing its constitutional right, their constitutional right to collectively bargain, to organize, you know, and to go on strike. Now, their constitutional right to their constitutionally guaranteed trade union and workers' right. You know? So that's a problem. You know? And that changed the whole political dynamic in the country. So that's one major change. The other major change that I could think of is that it has created a society where the rich and the poor, the difference, the gap between them has become so wide, and that opened up the possibilities for right-wing governments to rise. And I know that that sounds familiar. I guess that's what you hear in the U.S., no, and in other countries as well, no, even in Europe today. But that's a fact. No, about in 1986, we kicked out the dictatorship, the Marcos dictatorship, and I was actually part of that generation. I was out there in the streets, and that was my political baptism, if you like. You know, I was part of that generation who kicked out the Marcos dictatorship almost four decades ago, and we promised ourselves never again. That was our slogan: never again, never again would we ever allow a dictator to rule us. And yet, in 2016, Duterte was elected by the people with a very, very wide margin against all his competitors. You know? And that really changed the whole regime in the country. We don't have we formally still have our rights and our constitution. But you always feel like you have, you know, that feeling. You always feel like you are in a dictatorship. What's the most bizarre thing is that, despite the fact that this government has utterly failed in dealing with COVID-19, you know, just like Trump, you know, despite the fact that that it has no clue on how to deal with the economic repercussion of the pandemic, no strategy on how to deal with it, despite all these horrendous errors that it has had in the past 7 months, you know what? The president still enjoys 91% trust rating. It's so bizarre, you know? And so when people ask me, how do you explain it? It really is very hard to explain. And the only thing I can... you know, the only guess I can hazard is the fact that I think for the longest time we have underestimated the gravity of the frustration that people actually felt for, you know, three decades after kicking out the Marcos dictatorship. None of them feel that they have benefited from some what was thought to be the dividends of democracy at that time. No? So I think we have underestimated the gravity, the frustration that people feel about that. And at the same time, we have underestimated as well how deeply buried in the political psyche of many working people in the country, this whole belief in the myth of strong leadership. It's amazing. You know, it's amazing. You can still hear people... you know, waxing lyrical about the Marcos dictatorship as a golden age, you know, if you like, you wouldn't believe it, no? But that's how it is, no? So globalization, going back to your question, I'm sorry, Sophia, if I'm just running around with your question, but going back, the globalization has had so much impact on us that we now have to deal with Duterte.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many fascinating points there, and you put it in such a great way, because you can see those sort of international and global threads, and especially with things coming out of the 1980s and that birth of like neoliberalism and kind of birth of the idea even of spreading democracy in a more modern sense, selling this idea of, you know, Coca-Cola and jeans and everybody's going to be rich, drive a car.
That's right.
That, like, but at the same time, like, going in there and taking away traditional livelihoods and taking away traditional, like, people's power. You know, it happened in the U.S. too. Like, lots of like rural communities and plenty of places left behind.
That's right. Or,
you know, exact same thing. Like, yeah, it's that strong man comes in and says, like, you know what? I could push out those people. But at the same time, the strong man's just, like, grabbing stuff for themselves and helping those people hand over fist. But I also, you know, feel like in this day of social media and interaction and that constant bombardment, it's so easy to sell falsehoods. Because, you know, it's that classic like propaganda thing that if you keep repeating it over and over and over again. And with social media, it's so easy to repeat things. You just pay somebody and you'd have those ads blasted out there all the time.
Yeah, that's true. That's so true. I think this strong leadership, this myth of strong leadership, one of the, you got to hand it to them. They know how to play with people's psyche. You know, they know how to play with people's minds and aspirations and hopes and twist it, you know, and run with it without actually delivering anything. And so that's just amazing, you know, how they can do this.
Well, it's crazy. Two things I want to ask. Like, one of them, well, before getting to the thing of going back a bit further, I'm somewhat curious because you see this in some countries where the right-wing dictatorship people start claiming that the other people are dictators and they're actually the ones fighting against the dictators. So, I mean, because you see that in like Poland where it's like, you know, the Law and Justice Party is claiming there are communists everywhere that they're fighting against and we don't want to go back to that, but they're using the exact same techniques and actually bringing a lot of old authoritarians into the party. So I wasn't sure if there was a dynamic like that going on.
The major difference here is that Mr. Duterte never hid from the public his agenda. He never hid it. He was very, very open. When he ran in 2016, he did warn everyone, do not vote for me because blood will flow in our country and I will kill thousands if I have to. He even bragged that he will kill more people than Hitler ever did, you know, if only to stop drugs. That's the mantra. That in itself is a very interesting story. I don't know if you'll be able to use it, but I just want to tell you this. In 2015, a year before the elections, surveys have consistently shown that the concerns of many of the voters are actually, you know, ordinary working class issues, you know, jobs, you know, rising prices, low wages. These are bread and butter issues of the working class. That was in 2015. And then Duterte started joining the fray. In the late 2015, he started implying that he might run, and then he'll say, no, I probably won't. No, I would run. No, I probably won't. And that was his style, you know. And you know what? When he finally decided, no, don't ask me to run, because if I run, I'm going to kill all those bastards who are selling drugs to our kids. You know, drugs. Drugs is the main menace. Drugs is the main problem. It's the root of all evil in this country. It's going to destroy our country. And you know what? In just a few months, the whole thing turned. Next survey, you see the number one issue became drugs. It's just incredible, you know, how they were able to tap into the fears and to the anxieties and to the frustrations of people, and then turn this into such a huge issue that everything now has to do about drugs. No, and then he said, he promised that as soon as if you vote for me in 6 months, I will solve this drug problem. Then a few months later, after he won the elections, he said, oh, the drug problem is so long, it will take me more than my term. and that's
a little bit of a bait and switch.
I haven't completed my story. Oh. And that's after killing at least 10,000 people at that point. Today, really? Oh yeah. Today we had the police statistics would say that they have gunned down 5,800 plus drug suspects. And they allege that in most cases that these people tried to fight the police, you know, with guns. Can you imagine? But various human rights groups have been saying that the actual count could be as high as 27,000. As 27,000 since he became president in 2016. Now, let me give you a sense of, you know, a sense of proportion here. Marcos ruled the country for more than 20 years, and he killed 3,700 people. He tortured tens of thousands, but he killed 3,700 people. 20 years, right? Duterte has been ruling us for only since 2016, so for only the past 4 years. And he has already killed anywhere from 27,000 to 30,000. That's very different.
That's very different. That's sobering. I had no idea that that was going on.
Oh, that's what we have been dealing with from day one. This is actually, and we knew that this will happen. We knew, and people knew this would happen. They knew. Because when he was the mayor of, he loves calling himself mayor rather than the president. When he was a mayor of Davao City, and Davao City is a city in the south, in Mindanao, which at one point in time has been known as the Wild Wild West, if you like. And when he became the mayor there, he loves to point out that he was able to instill peace and order in the city. But the way he did that is that he launched a really punishing assassination program, which included kids. You know, any petty criminal, they would just gun them down, leave their bodies in the streets, you know, to sow fear, you know, among the people. And he was, but just the same, he was able to portray that he has managed to, you know, put peace and order in the city. And that was what that was the image that his promoters actually masterfully projected during the elections. So this is our guy. This is the solution. This is our hero. You know, so that's how he did it. No? So that's the reason why Centro in 2016 was the only trade union center in the country that actually came out with a statement warning voters, particularly the workers, not to vote for, you know, neo-fascists, you know, like Duterte. And Marcos, who is the son of Marcos at that time, was also running as the vice president. We warned people, don't vote for them. Beware, you know, we are warning you. The moment you vote for these people, you wouldn't know where they will turn their guns to. You know, and true enough, you know, like, you know, we ended up being very prophetic about it. You know, so now we're still dealing with a lot of killings. Can you imagine? We've been in a lockdown situation since March. In the first 4 months of the lockdown, killings because of war on drugs actually rose by 50% compared to the 4 months before the lockdown. Think about that. It's just incredible. No? So this is a killing. This is a country where, in the name of the war on drugs, people can easily be gunned down. And at one point in time, especially when the administration started, this regime started, there were a lot of news that says that every police precinct are actually given a quota on how many bodies they should be able to show. And those who can provide dead bodies gets bonuses. Dead bodies, bonuses. That's how peace and order. So, but as I said earlier, 4 years into his war on drugs, the drug problem has never abated. It is still there, primarily because they have never run after the drug dealers themselves. At one point in time, a guy suspected of being a major drug dealer was actually a guest of the president, you know, in Malacanang Palace. That's the presidential palace. You know, can you imagine? You know, so it's in this. So this whole war on drugs has nothing to do with the war on drugs. The whole thing has nothing to do with drugs. It is a war against the poor. It is a weapon in order to sow fear among the population, and that's the way he gets away with everything he wants. But I'm sorry, I might be veering off from our discussion. But I'm very very sure when I say that this has to do with what globalization has done in the fabric of society in this part of the world. It has destroyed people's faith and trust in the system, which made them very, very vulnerable to the demagogic manipulations of people like Duterte.
This is giving us such a rich contextualization of the situation that you're in and dealing with And I think that, you know, this has been a really important glimpse for our listeners into understanding the wider issues that are going on. And I think that that's good, because in all of these things that we talk about, you know, whether it be labor movements, other resistance, extractivist practices and the infiltration of extractivist logics, the contextualization of the actual life experience within these places is so important to understand, because these issues don't happen in a vacuum.
That's right. And that's the reason why the ITUC, the Global Trade Union Movement, has always put the country in the past 4 years on top as a, you know, the top 10 in terms of one of the worst violators of trade union and workers' rights in the world, consistently. Always top 10, no? This is also a country where you can find the most number of environmentalists who gets killed every year, you know? So the whole fight for rights, for justice, of various movements, practically all movements, from the workers' movements to the peasants' movements, to the youth, to the environmental movement, yeah, to the women's movement, no? All their struggles are actually happening in a situation where they can easily be killed. No, and that gives you a different kind of a flavor for, you know, for the kind of environment the kind of environment that we have to struggle within.
With all of this, I mean, with this environment, and as well, like going back to what you were describing with how the labor has shifted from becoming a regular worker to that endo-contractual, going from like 90% worker to like 10% contract to flipping it around. So, I mean, in this type of environment where it's so dangerous for activists, where, you know, it's very tough for union organizers, how have unions survived even with the dwindling numbers and this sort of harsh climate?
Well, that's one thing that I can be proud of. I mean, I think the labor movement is in its one of its relatively weaker moments compared to our whole history. But the fact that it's still here and it's still struggling and it's still fighting for rights is in itself, you know, something that people should be very proud of. More importantly, what happened with this whole regime change, if you like, no, in the country, the regime change in the labor market, the regime change in politics, the regime change in economics. No, what happened is that it also forced many of the unions in this country to start realizing that their very own survival rests in learning how to work together. Now, let me contextualize that a bit. This is a country where the whole labor code was designed to keep the trade union movement divided. And I always have a joke. If you have 10 Filipinos, put them in a room, ask them to form a union, you'll get 11. Let them stay for 5 more minutes, you probably end up with 12. Because now everyone felt that they are all vulnerable with contractualization, with a harsh political environment, you know, with this very, very strong anti-union stance of many of our employers. It actually forced many of the unions who used to fight each other ideologically, politically, organizationally together. So I am part of a coalition. My organization, Centro, is one of the co-founders of a broad coalition called NAGAISA. It's a Filipino word for solidarity. And it has managed to band together, you know, the biggest unions in the country that are ideologically situated from the right to the left. We managed to do this in 2012, way back in 2012. So this coalition is still going on for the past 8 years. But can you imagine? That was in 2012. Just months before that, you cannot imagine leaders of these various unions sitting together in one table in one room without actually killing each other. so, so, But because of the gravity of the challenges that we are facing, everyone was just, you know, it's just a force to, you know, to try to, you know, to rise above themselves, you know, and see, you know, how we can work together. So there's a silver lining, if you like, you know, in this situation. But obviously, I would rather have a different context. I would rather be unified in a different context than where we are right now.
So with this context that you are in, which seems like a very, very difficult context, what kind of issues are you specifically working on in the labor movement? Like, is the contractualization the kind of top priority, or what's going on?
Well, in the past few years, the contractualization was the major agenda of the labor movement. For the past 20 years, we, particularly my organization, I myself have been involved in trying to push for a legislation that we call a security of tenure bill. You know, and essentially, it aims to strengthen the constitutional provision for security of tenure. No, in the country, and it's aimed at addressing this whole problem of contractualization. But here's one of the interesting twists in the story. It actually ran on a platform against contractualization, and that's the reason why almost all unions except ourselves, you know, gave him the benefit of the doubt. We knew that he won't do it. We knew he would renege. We knew that he will launch a massive killing spree in the country. We knew that because we have been working and have been organizing in Davao when he was a mayor. We knew. We tried to organize the youth in Davao during the time that he was a mayor. You know, these are the street kids, out-of-school youth kids who formed groups. And they started dancing in the streets, and they started competing with each other like gangs, you know, dance gangs, you know, that they do drugs, they do whatever, you know, petty crimes. But we organized them. One of our youth organizers at that time said that, you know, these kids need a new direction. And he worked with them. And after a few months, it paid off. It paid off because the kids started realizing, oh, shit, there's more to life. Wow, after hearing what Centro is all about, what the labor movement is all about, what the values of the movement are, they said, well, this is something that we want. This is, you know, so this is something that we can dedicate our lives to. So remember, these are young kids, and these are youngsters, lumpen proletariats, if you like, but youngsters, no? They suddenly realized that there is more to life than what they have been doing. And so they started, you know, using their talents, dancing, for the cause. That's the reason why we can call for a massive flash dance before, during the time of Duterte. We just call for a mass flash dance, and all these gangs would come together. They stop fighting. They stop fighting. They stop using drugs, you know, and they would dance for the cause. But guess what? Of the 8 leaders that headed these groups, 5 were gunned down, even after we have reformed them. So that's the reason why we are very, very sure of ourselves when we say you cannot. But unfortunately, you know, nobody listened. No? So that's the situation. That gives you, you know, kind of a picture of what we're dealing with. So going back to your question, so how is it possible for the labor movement to survive? Well, it's simple. Workers have no other choice but to fight. In a situation where there is massive oppression, there would always be people. I have this very, very strong faith that people would always fight. Maybe not all of them, most likely not all of them, but there would always be people who would decide to stand up, you know, gain the courage enough to stand up and decide that this is enough, you know? And I think that the courage of that person is so infectious that they can actually, you know, start a movement. And so that's one reason. No? The movement has been alive, particularly my own organization has been alive, because we are very dedicated people who believe that this is not work. We don't consider what we do as work. We consider this as our life. It's a vocation. These are people who are completely devoted to the idea that there is a better deal out there for us, that there is a better world that we can build, other than this whole hell of neoliberal globalization, if you like. So that's one. The other is that, at least for my movement, I can only speak for my movement, I think the power of education is also very strong. We put a lot of our energies and emphasis on providing education to our workers, to our members, and to the point that every member of the union in my organization would have to go through a series of education programs. Some of them are one-day programs, some of them are two-day programs, depending on the capacity of the union. But everyone goes through a minimum of a one-day orientation. We call it basic trade union seminar, where they get to understand the situation. They get to understand what unionism is all about, its principles, its values, and more importantly, what their roles are. And then they have to move on to the next training, which is about social movement unionism, where we try to dwell more deeper into what are the structural issues in the country, and why and how why it is important for the union to deal with it, and how can the union be an instrument of change, So this ideological exercise, if you like, obviously is useful for us, but we've always believed that the real education for our members does not come from the trainings that they get from the classrooms. It's actually the most important education that they get is when they are in action, when they are in combat. That's when trade unionists, that's when workers actually become trade unionists. And from being a trade unionist, many of them would eventually graduate to be, socialists. Once trade union leaders who believe that there is a need for structural change in the country. So those are the key reasons why we are still alive as a movement. Apart from the fact that we have a very long tradition of the working class fighting for liberation, fighting against oppression.
Also within that, I was doing some background reading, and it seems like you've also been doing some work on the environmental front too. How do you link environmental issues and labor unionism? Where do those come together?
Well, to be honest, full disclosure, I don't think we in my organization, I don't think we're doing as much as we should be doing, given the context, given the crisis, the environmental crisis that we have. To be honest, I'm not happy with what we are doing. I think we should be doing more. But it's very late in the game when we realize that no amount of discussions and conferences and trainings about the threats of climate change in the year so and so would motivate people to actually work. I think we realized later on, after so many years of trying, we realized that the only way that we can motivate people to actually struggle for climate justice is when you link their day-to-day issues with the climate crisis. Let's take the case, for example, this whole idea of just transition. So that was a pretty good idea coming from the global labor movement, right? It could have its own reformist slant, but it also could also have a transformative slant, if you like. But let's take that case. How do you push for just transition in a situation where people are still hungry, people are still looking for jobs, and when they have jobs and when they do get the chance to actually form the union, they are so busy dodging bullets? How do you ask them to think about just transition? Well, it came to us because people were actually struggling for it, and we just have to name it. What am I referring to? We've been organizing in the informal side of things. We have been organizing the jeepney drivers in the Philippines. So I don't know if you've seen a jeepney, but essentially jeepneys are iconic vehicles that were that had its origins from the jeeps that were used by the GIs, the government, you know, by the soldiers, no, during World War II, by the American GIs. They left so much jeeps around that, you know, the innovative Filipinos started tinkering with it and converting them into a passenger jeep. And that's why it's called jeepney. So it became iconic because it became colorful, you know, and you stretched it, you packed more people in it, and it's the cheapest way of moving around. Now, for several governments, they have been blaming jeepneys for all the air pollution that we have in the city, which is partly true, but that's not entirely true. But that's a convenient scapegoat because they don't want to deal with all the factories that are spewing carbon. So they can deal with these poor jeepney drivers and blame them, right? So, but here's the thing. It is true that the jeepneys are using secondhand vehicles, most of them diesel engines that came from Japan, secondhand ones. So you can just imagine how much pollutive they are, right? And so when this whole program of modernizing public transportation came, we had a very long and honest debate with our leaders in the transport industry. And we asked them, listen, there is a need for us to deal with climate change, but there is also a need for us to transform the things that you're driving, because they are, you know, they are contributing to the climate crisis. And it wasn't so hard for us to convince them that that if given the chance, they would be very happy to transition to a cleaner engine, provided that they have a chance to do so and that the government would help them. And we said that, hey, you know, now that the government is calling for modernization without actually providing them with any alternative, imagine it, the government wants to phase out all these jeepneys. And just to give you a context, in Metro Manila alone, there are 55,000 jeepneys, 55,000. Roughly, that would be driven by around, you know, double that, so that you can have two drivers in each of them. Then you're dealing with more than 100,000 workers, right? So the government, even previous governments, wanted to just phase them out and then leave them to fend for themselves. And we said, you can't have that. We cannot have transport modernization without providing alternatives to all these workers. So we fought back. And the jeepney drivers have been fighting back. So no administration, previous administration, were successful in actually implementing modernization program, no? Their modernization program. Then comes Duterte, strongman, dictator. I don't want these jeepneys, you know? And he said, just phase them out. And so we went on strike. In 2017 and 2018, we did a series of strikes that paralyzed key cities, not just parts of Metro Manila, but actually key cities outside of Metro Manila. We were able to put on a standstill because of these transportation strikes. And that forced the government to back off. You know, and we told them that, listen, we can only accept a transport modernization program if there is a just transition. And the just transition for us is that government should provide subsidies to these workers so that they are able to purchase new vehicles that are using cleaner energies. Obviously, we wanted an electric jeepneys, but the technology then and up to now is not yet present here. Now, unfortunately, we have a very rough road system that a lot of the e-jeepneys, e-tricycles, whatever that were experimented here didn't last so long. Primarily because the batteries just won't last. No? So since that the technology is not there, we still have to use fossil fuel engines, but it must be the ones that are cleaner. That still is going to contribute to somehow. No? And so that was our just transition program, and we were able to win some breathing space for the transport workers to convert themselves into cooperatives so that now they would deal with the government as one organization and then run a fleet collectively, which is also good. No, but then came pandemic. And the government, because they're not able to phase out the jeepneys, the pandemic became a perfect excuse for them to say, listen, no public transportation, so no jeepneys allowed. and they were able to reduce thousands of drivers into beggars up to now, up to today, for 7 months. After 7 months, only around 30% of the jeepney drivers in Metro Manila are able to ply their trade. The rest are still, you know, still not able to earn a living, forcing them to vacate their apartments and whatever homes they're renting and live in their jeepneys. Literally live in their jeepneys. So a lot of them, when you go out in the streets of Metro Manila, you'll find people just practically begging, and you can be sure that they are jeepney drivers. So that's where we are right now. We're still trying to push for push government. We have actually succeeded during this pandemic. We have succeeded in pushing government to provide budget, public funds that would allow local governments to hire these jeepney drivers as a service contract. That would allow them, and we said that that's the safe way to convey people during a pandemic, because jeepneys are open air, you know, it has complete ventilation, and that makes it safe, right? And but the only way that you can safely drive them around without infecting people is that you ask the jeepney drivers not to fill up their vehicles, so they can only operate at 50% capacity, which is fine. But then, financially, it won't be viable, no, for many of these transport workers. So the only way for that to be viable is for government to pay them a fixed amount of income every day, and then they can ply their trade and provide services to people. So we want that. During the pandemic, we want that. And yet the government still doesn't want to use that fund in order to allow jeepney drivers to go around. And that's the reason why 2 weeks ago, they filed a case in the Supreme Court calling foul. They filed a case against government for discriminatory practice against them. So that's where we are right now. We're still in the midst of a pandemic, and we're still trying to transform transport workers into having the capacity to have modernized versions of their vehicles in order to be part still of the industry. So that's how we deal with climate issues. We were also able to deal with energy democracy. At that time, we didn't have any notion about energy democracy. Obviously, we were just fighting for jobs. So you see, in this country, the electrical power industry was privatized. And it was one of the biggest privatization initiatives in the country when we started embracing globalization. But rather than providing the promise of lowering the cost of electricity and making things much more efficient for everyone, we now suffer one of the highest electricity rates in the world, not just in Asia, in the world. We are consistently on top three highest rates in Asia, but from time to time, we would be on top five of the highest rates in the world. So, you know, very expensive electricity, top-notch price, with third world economy. So that's a problem. But the other problem that came with it is that when they privatized the main distribution system in Metro Manila and key cities, it was an afterthought. As an afterthought, they realized that a huge portion of all the rural areas and outside and key cities, even key cities outside of Metro Manila, were not being provided by the main company, but its distribution is provided by electric cooperatives. Now these are electric cooperatives are the things that were this is a concept that we actually borrowed from the U.S. You do have electric cooperatives in the U.S. No, it was borrowed by the government during the time of the Marcos dictatorship, you know, as a way of electrifying the rural areas. And true enough, we have spent billions, the state has spent billions in building up these electric cooperatives. But now that they have privatized the industry, and now that the electric cooperatives are able to operate and provide electricity to, you know, to their franchise areas, government now and employers wanted to privatize them as well. That's where we came in. we were organizing the workers in electric cooperatives, and then they are suddenly threatened with privatization, with or corporatization, if you like, and they started pushing back. But then we said, listen, there's no way that people in your community would defend you unless you can tell them that defending you is worth it. Now, why would they defend you when the electric cooperative is not providing efficient services, high electricity rates? And how can you provide better services and lower electricity rates when you depend on the grid with all these corporations providing you with electricity? Shouldn't the electric cooperatives be producing its own electricity using renewable energies? We asked them to start rethinking what a strong union means in their context. We try to explain to them that in your context, what it means to have a strong union is not just having a good leadership and well-oriented members who are thoroughly organized. It also means that you have this massive support of the people that you're supposed to be servicing, so that if there's any attack, to try to corporatize or privatize the electric cooperatives, then their first line of defense would be the people themselves. So you have to start working with them, while at the same time, you have to start working with your management, because it's supposed to be a cooperative. It's supposed to be a democratic institution. But in fact, it's not, because in many electric cooperatives in this country, they're really run like the personal kitty of the mayor or of the governor. It's run in a corrupt way. So we said that a strong union actually means that it works with a strong consumer base, that is organized, and a professional management that actually believes in the concept of cooperatives. So that's how we redefine what unionism means, which means that you're no longer fighting for your jobs. You're actually fighting for people's access to energy. And so we didn't have the word for it at that time. We're just using the idea that, well, this is what it means to have strong unions. And then I met the trade unions for energy democracy, Sean Sweeney, for example. So I got into a discussion with Sean Sweeney. And then I heard that word, energy democracy, and it's just, that's it. That is what we have been doing. and the major test for us was when they tried to privatize, they actually privatized a company, an electric cooperative in a province called Albay. It's the southern part of Luzon, which is one of the more stronger unions that we have, luckily for us. And the union leadership immediately decided, no, we can't do this. We will fight this. We will resist this. And they started building up they helped build up the consumer group, educated the consumer group, built them up as a strong advocacy group. They started and then they started working with politicians and everyone else. And then we started pushing back. And we developed this concept of union to union. Why sell the company when we can have a union to union or cooperative to cooperative idea, where the other cooperatives in other provinces can help our cooperative so that we all, move together? And we did with the help of academics who were so inspired by the resistance that these academics actually just offered their help, and they did all the calculations, all the economic calculations, and we presented it to the the Secretary of Energy at that time in the previous administration, we told them that we proved to them that a co-op solution is much more viable, financially, politically, economically, than corporatizing it, than letting corporations run it and then pass on the cost to the consumers. It was so simple. And we were able to calculate that. And the Secretary of Energy himself told us in front of us after we were arguing with him. They told us that, man, yeah, you're right. This is true. I think this is a very viable option. And then he turned around the next day and he called for a referendum. And then they started buying the votes of all the consumers. And we lost the vote. But that we didn't give up. So yes, we lost the vote. And yes, the company took over. A company took over the electric cooperative. But the union went on a strike. We went on a 2-year strike. And the main call, and this is one of the fun things about this struggle, the main call was, well, let's call for a boycott. Nobody should pay electricity because this is an electricity where a corporation is trying to profit from us, from everyone. We have a right to use electricity, but no one pays electricity. And hey, who would want to pay the electricity? So nobody paid electricity. And so the new corporation had so much problem that they had to send teams. Literally, they had to build teams whose only job is to try to cut off the electricity connection of communities. Okay, so that's fine. You know what the union's response was? Well, we built our own flying squads whose only job is to reconnect these people. And we called that, provide them with what we call lifetime service. So long as the wires are connected, you get free electricity. And so it keeps good, you know, so that the company would come in, they cut it off, then we send our flying squad, we put it up again. It got to a point where in some communities, the people themselves got so pissed off with this corporation that they started defending the lines. So when the corporation came in and their own workers started going up the pole and trying to cut it off, you know, the people would actually mobilize around them, surround them and say, you just try to cut that off and you won't be able to get down here. The strike went on 2 years. It was so punishing, you know, to the point that the corporation doesn't really know how to deal with the workers. And so they just had to file, you know, criminal charges left and right. A lot of the workers suffered in this way, but they continued the fight. We lost. To be honest, after two years, we lost. The government decided that the strike was illegal and that the people would just have to be paid their separation pay. We lost that. No? So industrially, we lost. But politically, it was such a punishing effort for corporations that no corporation ever dared to do another thing like that again. So that's how we were able to push for energy democracy. And now the unions that are still fighting, they're now the ones at the forefront of convincing their own management to start developing the renewable energy. We're actually helping them, no? Do their own studies, do their own optioneering paper, if you like, to see which renewable energy is the optimal thing that they can use, and then help them lobby for funding so that they can do this. So it's the unions who are now pushing for renewable energy as a way to keep the company much more on a more solid footing, so that that cannot be used against them to be privatized. You know, and in a way to defend, in other words, to defend their jobs, the union believes that they have to fight for energy democracy. That was the whole idea, no? And we're still fighting. Unfortunately, now with Duterte having a super majority in Congress. When I say super majority, it means that of the 300 congressmen in the lower house, you can only count, I don't know, less than 10 opposition. And that's what I say. Well, that's what I mean when I say supermajority. You know, so now that they have the supermajority, they're trying to push for a law that would actually sell the franchises of existing electric cooperatives to corporations. So now they have devised a way. They knew that they cannot fight us at the ground. So now they're using legislative process as a way to undermine, you know, people's right to energy democracy. And so going back to your question, original question, and I'm sorry it took me so long to answer this. Going back to the original question, so how do we fight for climate in this context? Well, we fight for climate justice by making sure that it is actually linked to the day-to-day struggles of our members.
Okay. Wow, that is an amazing view into sometimes, like, I come from the academic sphere. I've always been in the academic sphere. And hearing for me, this is like a real life illustration of like what it means when we say that something's a wicked problem. because there's so many different strands and a concept that, you know, seems fairly straightforward. Like, of course, just transition, like we'll solve sustainability by having just transition. It'll be easy. No problem. Who doesn't want justice? But, you know, hearing this story and all the kind of complications and barriers and blocks and losing the battle, but still, like, you know, some successes within, like, the war against.
Yeah, exactly. Those were the words used. No, we lost the battle, but we are still winning the war, if you like.
Yeah, but that's just such a beautiful, not beautiful example. It's a really gut-wrenching example of, like, the struggles that are actually happening on the ground. But I think that it's a very poignant illustration of why some of these concepts that it seems like, oh yeah, everybody should be behind sustainability, but it's not that simple. Like, in the actual lived experience, especially against the backdrop that you've given us of the overarching socio-political situation in your country.
All right. So you have the big question.
The question. So
the question.
The question.
The question.
The question.
It's the question.
So the question basically is, it's for our listeners at home. We want it to be a sort of call to action. What can your average person do to be able to, like, if they hear this, they're inspired, they want to do something. What can they do? What can they learn? How can they get involved? How can they support and make a difference just as your average individual?
Well, that is the question, all right? That's a really tough question to answer. Well, I think we all have our roles to play, and for your listeners out there who hopefully would be inspired to do something to change the world, I think the good news is there's a lot of things that they can do, but they have to do it not just individually; they have to do it together with other people. I'm not a believer. I'm afraid I'm not a believer in simply doing modeling the lifestyle of what a person should do in order to have a sustainable society. That's great, but we're fighting systems, and it cannot be fought by lifestyle change alone. No, it has to be fought in an organized fashion. So I'd say that if you're an ordinary, I really don't know what an ordinary person means, but I'd say that I think there is always a chance for people to find a way to work with other people in order to change things that are around them. I remember when I was still in the university, I knew that it was so hard at that time too, because it was also martial law at that time. And I knew that it was hard to organize students at that time, in my school at least. But you know what was very interesting? One of the key issues that actually got the students to organize was not the tuition fee, not the horrendous teachers, not whatever it is that the student movement would always organize around, but it's the toilets. It's the stinking toilets, you know, toilets that don't work. Can you imagine? You know, the guys can't even stand using the toilet. Now, can you imagine what it means for the women? So, is stinking toilets in a public school that really managed to mobilize the students and to fight for it at a time when there was a Marcos dictatorship? Now, what am I saying? I'm just saying that I think there's always something that we can. There is something that we can always do, but it's best that we do it together, because the only way that we can change the world is if we change it together with other people. Now, you might have to start with just your friend, the two of you. That's a start. You know, for those believers out there, Jesus Christ started with one. You know, he just mobilized a disciple of 12, and he managed to create a movement. You know, and to me, that should be the model. No, would be great if you could join a union. That would be fantastic. You know, but you don't have to do that, you know, if you're not into it. But please think about contributing to change in a collective fashion. The only way we can change this world is if we change it together. I don't know if that's the answer to your D question, but that's the best I can give you at this point in time.
No, that's a great answer.
Well, I hope so. I hope your listeners would find it as such.
Thank you so much. Is there anything else that you'd like us to link, for example, down in the show notes if our listeners are interested in learning more about your organization or what you've been up to?
I think they can always go to our website. But if they want to hear more about struggles that are similar to ours, then I would advise them to go to the website of the Siena Process, because there you will find a lot of stories that are similar to what we are doing, or even better. And there's a lot of resources that you can do. We can use, download and use, and start things for yourself.
Wonderful. We'll make sure to link to that in the show notes.
All right.
Joshua, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. I mean, so fascinating, so powerful. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, right. Thank you so much.
Good luck to you. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye. Right. Thank you again to Joshua Mata for coming on and sharing his amazing experience and insight with us. Please join us next month when we'll be talking with Alexander Dunlap about how simply labeling something green does not necessarily make it good, the importance of local consent in green energy projects, and how extractivism can even seep into quote-unquote green energy. From the muddy forests and slowly lengthening days of Helsinki, Finland. On behalf of Sofia Hagelani-Albov, we want to thank everyone who's been tuning in and listening all through 2020. This has been an unprecedented year, filled with both loss and challenges, but as well visions for how things can change for the better in the future. If 2020 has shown us anything, it's that the future is not written in stone, and we look forward to going into 2021 with you, filled with hope, seeing potential for the future, and being ready to act to make the world a better place. If you've been enjoying our podcasts and have not subscribed and left us a rating, please do. It helps us to better share these stories and knowledge. We wish everyone who's celebrating a happy holiday season, and we hope that everybody out there has a safe season and a wonderful start to 2021. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time.